Thank you.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Well, good morning, everybody. Today is Friday, it's July 2nd, 10 o'clock on the Eastern Seaboard. Well, we've got really phenomenal guests today, none other than Dr. Neda Sayer. She's the New York State Assemblyman representing Assembly District 90, which is comprised, about 75% of it is comprised strictly of Yonkers. It's one of the few districts that is specific to one city or one locale. And usually it's shared by one or two, sometimes even three districts. So it makes it very unusual. And then at 11 o'clock, I'm going to speak to Richard Thomas, the former Mount Vernon mayor. And we'll talk to him about, just the different candidates that have come up for election. Some have already been vanquished before they've even begun, and others are so close, so we're not quite exactly sure what the final vote will be. Some of the races are literally 50 people, 50 votes apart. It's unbelievable. And yet what's really fascinating about it all is that we had very, very few people going to the elections this year, less so than ever before, and I don't exactly know why. It could be because it's a primary as opposed to a general election, but you would figure that there would be a lot more challengers, and they were. So even in Mount Vernon specifically, there were like three people from the Mount Vernon Forward that came in very high, but they only have a slight lead over other people that were coming into play. It's going to be very, very interesting how all this comes out. So we'll see where that goes. Okay, well, I've just got to check one last thing here. I think I'm going to need to check to see what's going on with Dr. Sayers and see if we can catch him somehow or another, because he's not on the line yet. And here he is. Perfect timing. Dr. Sayers, how are you, sir?
Good morning. How are you, Hezzy? How's it going? God bless. Always
Thanks, nice God, to be on
the show.
I'm excited when you come on, which is really terrific. You know, do people realize the heavy lifting that this this year's legislature had engaged in, particularly with the funneling of funds? It looks like we're in a much better way than we ever were. Is New York State flush with money for, what is it, 2 years tops? And what do we do for the balance? Are we planning for the future after that?
Well, we are. You're right. For the next 2 years, most municipalities and most state agencies and school districts are financially sound, I believe, for at least a two-year period. But my concern is, and I think most of us that are planning for further funding needed to take action, because, you know, the funding, which is a combination of state funding, as you know, the state funding, but the state budget this year was $212 billion. So there was a lot of money that went to school districts, coupled with the federal stimulus funds. As you know, Chuck Schumer, Senator Schumer, is the majority leader of the U.S. Senate, and Chuck Schumer really did a decent job in bringing federal funds to New York, among other places in the country. So with the combination of federal funds and state funds, as I said, we're pretty good for a two-year period. My concern and everyone's concern should be, what happens in year three when the federal funds really go away, they evaporate, we're out of the pandemic, then we have to rely totally on state funding. And state funding, we address part of it by increase in some taxation. But like we've seen across the nation in other states, anytime you overdo it on increasing taxation, you lose business, you lose development, you lose a lot of real estate, landlords and property value people, investors. So we got to be very careful that we don't lose our investment base. So taxation is good to get revenue for the future, to safeguard, you know, our needs in education and healthcare and other services. So to a large extent, you know, we're happy that there's a sense of stability for 2 years, but then legislators like myself are looking at year three and year four and moving forward to make sure that, you know, we continue to have stability, especially with education. You know, we don't, those of us that understand education know that, you know, overnight when you run out of money, the first thing to go is support services where, you know, people that are counselors and social workers and other type of programs like art and music and sports. These are the first programs to go. And we've seen it in Yonkers where, you know, overnight we have to cut sports and, you know, and a lot of kids function well academically when they're involved with these special programs or they have artistic talents or music or, you know, you have to cut library services or you have one counselor who's trying to counsel 1,000 kids. I mean, we know that doesn't work. You know, so so the good thing is with the educational funding, you know, we restored in a place like Yonkers a lot of these services, which is good. But again, you got to think ahead of the box. You can't be limited to, well, we're okay today and next year and, you know, I don't care about what happens. You got to care. And that's what, you know, we entrust legislators, whether local or state or federal, you know, to really think beyond the box and be proactive. And that's part of our mission.
I want to ask you about one of the problems in Yonkers has always been the cost of building new schools, and when our schools quite often are over 100 years old. And so it's not that they're falling apart, but they're old, and they don't have what's necessary, especially with today's pandemic going around. And there are even points, it's been pointed out that variants are coming around, and some countries are going to their third phase or the fourth phase of the pandemic, and these sort of things will probably continue to develop over the years. In the old days, we used to open the window in order to get ventilation. Well, that doesn't work anymore.
No.
So we probably need some equipment, and they do have equipment like that where you could use ventilators in the rooms. That could be quite expensive. Does the city have the funding capacity to do that sort of thing in order to secure safer environment?
But you're right. I mean, you know, vaccination, you know, I think we, to a large extent, met our goals. You know, we wanted to make sure we got up to the 70%. You know, so the science to, you know, to a large extent was really on target. You know, the science told us from a year ago, this is what we need to do in New York and elsewhere across the country and the world. We need to vaccinate to get what they call herd immunity. We needed to make sure that once we achieve the 70%, then to a large extent, situations will get better. And we know now, you know, the amount of people that are infected or hospitalized or the amount of people that got COVID or dying as a result of COVID is almost non-existent, and which resulted in the reopening of New York, of the economy.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're back to seeing, you know, sport arenas that are full with spectators, and we're seeing concerts, and, you know, we're seeing the city to some extent begin to come back to some sense of life where restaurants and businesses now have indoor dining. You know, if we recall, we went through a period where there was no indoor dining, where everybody had outside, you know, dining. And you're right. When it came to schools and education, we dealt with virtual learning. It was a serious concern because, honestly, many parents and many kids, A, did not have the proper technology, nor did they really know how to master virtual learning. So now that the push is to bring back normalcy in education and the pushes to open schools fully, whether on the public education pre-K to 12 or on the college level. You know, plans are being made, but part of the plans requires that the facilities and the areas of instruction are safe. And ventilation, mm-hmm. we know, is crucial. As you said earlier, Hezzy, you know, in the old days, you open a window and you get a little ventilation, but when you have buildings that are 100 years old, like we do in Yonkers and urban settings across the state, it's very difficult. You know, and to your point, yeah, there was some local and state and federal funds that were used to promote, let's say, more safety by putting the proper equipment to safeguard. But the bottom line is we got to do major shifting in the way we build and renovate schools moving forward, and that's going to require a lot more funds that's not going to be addressed with the extra funding we spoke about on the next 2 years.
Right.
So that's why one of my pieces of legislation, acknowledging exactly what you're talking about, requires the state to change the way it funds, let's say, public educational facilities and expansions and buildings of new schools. In a community like Yonkers, we don't get the proper amount of funding when we build a new school or renovate like they do in Buffalo and Rochester and Syracuse. We get a lot less funding. I've always challenged that. I've always made a point of saying that's unfair, that's inequitable, and that's, to a large extent, tied our hands as educators, as public officials representing, let's say, a community like Yonkers, where we can't afford to sometimes build a new school. When, even though they're giving you now up to 70 cents on a dollar, you know, it's still going to cost you $600 million that taxpayers have to pay. And imagine the amount of taxes you got to increase even to build a school to come up with $600 million. I mean, that's really unreasonable. You look at Buffalo, they get 98 cents on a dollar. So they can build, mm-hmm. and they did. They built a ton of schools. Meanwhile, you look at these upstate communities and elsewhere, they're losing enrollment. But here in Yonkers, our enrollment is increasing. So we got an increase in enrollment. Our hands are tied. We have a shortage of like 5,000 seats right now as of this school year. That's not fair. You know, kids are crowded. We take away libraries to make them classrooms. We take away music rooms. We take away other, you know, other facilities, supplemental to make them classroom instructions. We go into basement areas that really kids shouldn't be there, and we're putting classrooms there. So, you know, that's what we're confronted with when you have an infrastructure where your buildings are so old and not really safe, in my opinion.
Do you think, Assemblyman, do you think that in the future, while this the new funding is available, do you think that we have the 2 years ahead of us now to consider what to do about the funding formula? Is the state legislature a little bit more amenable to recognize that the funding formula has not been appropriately, created, and that there is bias and a deficiency there in the funding formula?
I agree with you. I think there's a change because, you know, historically, most of us from Yonkers over the last 40 years that have been trying to look at this have really looked at it from the Yonkers perspective. And politically mm-hmm. speaking, you know, why should people in upstate New York and western New York and elsewhere really care? You know, if they feel that giving Yonkers more money takes away from them, then politically their attitude is, why should we do it? What we've done differently.
Yeah, but let me interrupt very quickly. Let me interrupt very quickly. So I remember when you first ran, you recognized that Yonkers is not the anomaly in the state, and that the problems that faced Yonkers were also in Ossining and in Portchester and in places in Long Island and places in upstate. And you've reached out across the aisle, whether it be Democrat or Republican, because it was based on educational funding formulas. And you've been quite successful because of that. I don't know if you speak enough about it, because I think you get embarrassed by knowing how much you've done. So that's my job, to make sure that you get understood.
But I appreciate that. I really do. And, you know, what we've done is we said, you know what, this change of formula, which, of course, would be statewide, would impact mm-hmm. a lot of communities outside just Yonkers. And what we looked at, you know, what my legislation proposes is that, you know, let's modify the present formula that puts a lot of emphasis on the wealth of the county you live in or the city you live in. And we always say, you know, Yonkers, New York, Westchester, yeah, property value is very expensive. We know that. We're next to New York City. We're next to the Hudson. So there's a lot of reasons why there's population growth and there's, you know, development and property values are high. But then, you know, as an educator, as a former president of the Board of Ed, I know the numbers. You know, I know the social demographics. And when I see, like, our school district in Yonkers has anywhere from nearly 80% of our kids on free and reduced lunch, you know, it tells me, hey, there's inequity there. There's a problem with the way the state looks at how much money they give Yonkers per kid, right, based on the wealth of the property. But then I say, hey, 80% of our kids and their families don't own that property. So, you know, there's a serious problem with basing the formula largely on the wealth. So what I propose, along with the enrollment numbers, percentages of special ed, percentages of English language learners, you know, there's a lot of factors, but the main factor would be using the federal guideline that's been in existence, God knows for how many years, that has a basis or a criteria, you know, of determining how many kids are on free and reduced lunch. That free and reduced lunch formula, in my legislation or my opinion, should be the most important determining factor in how much kids are funded, because that's a true reflective factor, you know. So when you look at the proposed legislation that I propose, you know, clearly it states that any urban or any school district that has, for example, a 60% or higher of their students on free and reduced lunch should be given more funding, you know, and that's more equitable, that's more fair. And then you realize, like you said earlier, communities all across the state, like Ramapo and Port Chester and Peekskill and elsewhere, even communities around us in Westchester that are impacted by that have that 60% or higher. And you've had on the show the mayor, Garrity, of Ossining, the prior mayor, you know, who also was very thankful for being made aware of this issue on your show. And, you know, through these discussions, to continue to get the point across that this has to be a statewide formula change. And I think that it's gaining more support. I'm hoping that, you know, we can continue to rally behind it and eventually change. New Jersey, about a year and a half ago, changed its funding formula. So I'm saying to New Yorkers, hey, why continue to use a formula from 15 plus years ago that really promotes inequity? And that's the one thing we fight across the board. You know, the biggest thing is equity, making sure that there's equity in funding and the way we treat people, the way we give opportunities in every area. And, you know, the same goes for healthcare. Imagine if, you know, you get less health care in one community than another. That would be unfair. Same goes for education and for other services.
I wanted to ask you about something else, even though we're in a better place because new legislation has been approved by the state legislature and funding coming from the federal government to the state and then from the state to the county and from the county to the municipalities. We are very, very close to another crisis, which will probably foment within a few months, maybe tops no longer than 6 months from now. Many people face evictions. And
yeah.
Do we have an idea of what to do with that crisis? Because landlords haven't been paid. They have expenses. They have to keep up the facility in order for people to live in just a credible place. Does the state have the means to muddle through all of this? I mean, the expenses have to be huge.
But you bring up a good point. I mean, during the midst of the pandemic, the general consensus, which is based on good intent, good motive, was to avoid homelessness. And now I think everyone to a large extent had a sense of concern and compassion to make sure that, we addressed potential large-scale homelessness, people that were sick from COVID, people that lost jobs and careers. It was a serious problem. But my concern is, it's great to have in place services and programs, that safeguard, right? So the moratorium against evictions that we passed and extended right now till the end of August, this August, really tells landlords, hey, you can't evict someone because, the pandemic and all the concerns. But at the same time, we put fund in, we put programs in place that tells landlords and tells tenants, look, if you have an issue that you couldn't pay rent as a result of COVID, that layoffs, unemployment, whatever the case may be, here's funds that are available. You got to apply for them. This way you can get your past rent arrears paid up. And this makes everyone happy. But instead, unfortunately, as in any program that's government giveaway, there's always the potential of fraud and abuse. And like we saw with unemployment, how many cases now that the Department of Labor is investigating for fraud? How many people that have had their Social Security numbers stolen and people that are using their Social Security numbers to file for unemployment claims? It's widespread. And as a legislator, what I fought for, was whenever these programs were put on the table to be passed by the Assembly and the Senate, I took the position, along with many others, that, let's put safeguards in there. Like now, we know that for God knows how many years, we've had in place through Section 8 and Social Security and social service programs and so forth, we've had many programs that help those in need in America, right? But we made sure there was criteria. We made sure that people had to apply, they had to justify that there was a need, that there was eligibility. And I'm all for that. I'm all for making sure that as a nation, we're a nation that really provides services for the disenfranchised, for the disadvantaged, for the poor. And that's the right thing to do. But we also know that, unfortunately, when you open the door and you keep it too open and without criteria, without some sense of uniformity or verification, that people will abuse the process. And I've seen widespread abuse of the rent moratorium where people took the position of, hey, the government told me I don't have to pay rent, so why should I pay rent? Meanwhile, like you said earlier, a landlord has to still pay the taxes, they have to pay the mortgage, they have to pay utilities, they have to keep the building in tip-top shape. So, from the sense of the moratorium, what I see happening is people that follow the procedure the right way, I believe, will have their landlords paid from the state and other services, the rent arrear payment services that are available. But so many others that really didn't care about applying, right, kept the landlord hanging, they'll be facing massive eviction. And, then that's something, the government should learn from its experience, that you don't, open up programs without having criteria and eligibility and making sure that, there's a process where if the program is available and the landlord doesn't, the landlord, for example, is losing money, that and the tenant doesn't cooperate, that a landlord can apply without the tenant's cooperation. You know, so that's the type of difference I look at, always trying to be someone that looks at every side of the angle, somebody that tries to take into consideration, you know, the needs of both sides or both elements. And, you know, with the tenancy and the moratorium, you know, I believe that, you know, there's going to be a lack of justification to extend it beyond August 31st, because now we're not faced with COVID. You know, people, for example, many people out there that are offered jobs, you know, they're not even accepting their old jobs. You know, they sometimes, unfortunately, they made more money sitting home, right? So, you know, through stimulus funds and unemployment claims, people sat home and they said, why should I go work? Look at how many businesses are begging people and giving incentives, monetary incentive, where, you know, we'll give you $1,000, just come back and we'll pay you, you know, $15-$20 an hour and just come back and we'll give you this benefit. I mean, what have we done? Even though we've seen the unemployment numbers begin to dip a little bit, but it's still widespread. You know, we now, you know, there's nobody out there wearing masks. People are, like I said, are attending major sport events and concerts. And so we see the reopening, but then, you know, there's a problem where people are not accepting jobs as they should, or fast enough as they should.
Right.
So that's some of the issues that, you know, I think we're confronted with. I think as statewide, as a nation, you know, and maybe even globally, it's a problem that that we got to promote some corrections in there, you know. And
what
part
of it
starts with...
Go ahead, I'm sorry. Didn't mean...
No, but part of it starts with, you know, putting the brakes on, you know, some of the government services and programs to begin to say, you know what, we're out of COVID, we're getting the economy back in shape, you know, let's make it more difficult to stay on unemployment. Let's make it where, you know, you have an incentive to go back and find a job or get back to work, and, you know, so that we're not faced with the situations we're faced with now. You know, you hate to say it, but, you know, we're a nation that loves to help and give out, but we also understand, unfortunately, there's a lot of abuse, and the abuse at some point is going to catch up to us as a system, you know. And like I said, in a year or 2 years from now, we can't afford this, you know. So what do? Do we start cutting back dramatically then, and you have a serious concern, or do you start putting the brakes back and restoring some sense of stability?
Definitely. Those are major, major, major concerns. Do you think that we have to, as a society, do we need to move in a different direction? Do we need to pay people more? So, because even $15 an hour, that doesn't really work very much, even in a city like Yonkers. No,
sure.
Where can you go with $600 a week, assuming that you even get your 40 hours to earn $600 a week, and you have to pay taxes on top of that, too?
But you're right. You know, we've recognized, I mean, a couple of years ago, you're talking about most people being paid somewhere around $10 an hour, 12. You know, we're up to $14-$15 an hour. And people that are in jobs with stability, the average, you know, whether clerical, is anywhere from $16 to $22 an hour. I mean, if you have a decent employee, you know, you don't want to lose them, and, you know, you're paying quality. So I think, you know, you're right. You know, we need across the nation, you know, to bring more, you know, more equity or more uniformity to the way, you know, we pay, you know, so that, like we said earlier, you want to make sure there's an incentive where you rather pay someone more and give them enough money so they can pay their rent and educate their kids and pay whatever. And, you know, you're right. They can't do it on $12 and $14 or $15 an hour. So I rather pay someone more money and have them working and producing than honestly being forced to be on welfare and Section 8 and other, you know, government handouts. You know, that's the problem.
That's the other thing.
We've made it.
Yeah, go ahead, finish.
Yeah, but we've made it very difficult for people sometimes that want to work, but then if they earn a certain amount, they lose benefits. They may have children. They lose food stamps. They lose other services. Sometimes they lose housing. So it's almost like forces someone that wants to work, wants to make a living, but the criterias are so difficult to live by that, you know, forces someone to either work off the books or make other arrangements, and, you know, which again causes a problem. So you're right. I'm all for being realistic, paying people more money, make them feel that, you know, they're better off working than being home or sitting down or getting a handout.
Well, you know, what's interesting, we've got this gig economy where people might show up on a particular street and they do seasonal work like take care of shrubbery or, you know, cleaning up lawns and doing all kinds of work like that. But it's interesting that the same people who are in these sort of businesses pick them up and take them to wherever the job is. But we don't impose, if they're employing people, even though they're not employed in any other way, why don't we charge these people who are picking up these people who are not getting paid, no benefits, no nothing? Why don't we charge them? Why aren't they responsible? If they want to have a staff of people that they need and it's on a seasonal basis, why don't we charge the people who pick them up and take them to wherever the job is? Because they have no responsibility.
They should, but you know what is, from years ago, it was a combination where these individuals were providing cheap trade labor. Mm. And in many cases, you had a combination of whether individuals were undocumented, whether individuals didn't have proper work papers, and so at a certain point when this was going on, you know, people said, well, you know, I can pick up someone and pay them $100 a day or $150 a day,
right,
and have the, you know, cheap labor, and the other person would probably say, hey, you know, I don't have my proper papers and whatever, and, you know, so maybe this is a way for me to provide for my
right.
family and so forth. But I think over the last number of years, there's been a lot of improvement in that, where, you know, the amount of funds that are paid now have been increased. I think people are beginning to, you know, legalize themselves and now operate as contractors and therefore pay. Yeah, you know, it's happening more where people are opening businesses. Like years ago, many of these same landscapers you referred to, you know, years ago worked for other people, but they learned the trades, right? They learned the trade.
Mm-hmm.
They opened up legal businesses. They incorporated.
Mm-hmm.
And I've done, as an attorney, I've done corporations for many individuals that once worked for someone, and then they said, you know what, I really learned the business. And they would come and, you know, we would open up a new corporation, and they would open up an account and to get a tax ID and then become, you know, a full-fledged legitimate business operating, paying taxes and, you know, and hiring other individuals. And that's part of the American dream. I mean, that's something, you know, you compliment and commend when you see someone come and work hard, and I did it myself. I'm an immigrant. I mean, I came here when I was about 3-4 years old, and you know, I often tell the story, you know, my father died a young man, and, you know, 8 kids in the family, and, you know, even in elementary school, I used to go shine shoes in Southwest Yonkers, you know, to pay for school lunch and school trips and so forth.
Yeah.
So, you know, we did it. We know what it takes. As immigrant communities, you come, you work hard, you know, you live in these tenements in Southwest Yonkers, you know, 8 of us lived in a 3-bedroom, you know, but we survived. We learned the hard way, worked hard, we knew the value of a good education, And we see it happening with, you know, each ethnic group. You know, I look at a growing Mexican-American community that's now predominantly opening up the businesses in Southwest Yonkers, and I'm proud of that. You know, and being in Yonkers as long as I have, you know, I see the evolution of the different ethnic groups that came and they settled, you know, in that part of town, and, you know, they opened up businesses and delis and groceries and restaurants, and, you know, and they did trades and worked in various, let's say, you know, business-oriented settings, and they learned the trades, they became professionals, they educated their kids became doctors and lawyers and engineers and so forth, you know, and the rest is history. And, you know, some of them that never thought they had a future, you know, end up getting involved and running basic agencies and services in our cities and communities and becoming elected officials. And, you know, the rest is history. And then you watch other ethnic groups begin. And even last week, I was among a group of Mexican Americans and you know, had a long talk with them and basically said, look, you know, you got to get more involved. You're working hard. You're opening up businesses. Now you have to start, you know, getting some of your community members to serve on hospital boards and community-based agencies. And, you know, you got to promote the volunteerism, the giving back, and, you know, get your community registered to vote and speak up and, you know, continue to focus on education, your children. And that's, you know, it's become a scientific formula. It's become a basis for, you know, being successful. And it's not reinventing the wheel. You know, I look at old communities that are well established and how they started off, the same thing.
Exactly.
But, you know,
I want to ask you about the – Go ahead.
No, but I'm saying, you know, with the July 4th weekend coming and, you know, one of the biggest issues, you know, that I've had, especially the last year and a half, maybe with the prior presidential race and the Black Lives Matters movement and the George Floyd matter, we've had so much polarization in our nation and our community. You know, my hope is that with this July 4th weekend, you know, we can begin to restore, you know, trust in each other, respect for diversity, you know, have more pride, you know, and of course, continue to focus on equality and begin to look at ourselves as one nation, one people. You know, we've lost a lot of that. And, you know, my weekly newsletter, you know, we always try to focus on, you know, trying to look at the positive that brings us together. And my hope is that, you know, we've gone through a tough two-year period. And my hope is that we begin, you know, to bring back the sense of stability and normalcy with how we function as a society, to bring back, you know, respect for, you know, patriotism and respect for the flag and really the Constitution and equality. And that's something that as a nation, as a people, and right here in Yonkers and New York State, we need to take the lead in bringing back that sense of normalcy.
Well, that would be absolutely wonderful, and it's a good road to forge. I want to ask you about one last thing when it comes to earning capacity. The government actually spends money in what they call the earned income tax credit. So in other words, if you work but you don't earn that much money, the company you work for ends up filing papers for these workers who they pay below standard rates, what they call an earned income tax credit. But that actually compensates the company for, you know, getting these workers. And the workers don't make the money out of it because it's really subsidizing the company. So it would be the Walmarts of the world or places like that. They are making a fortune of money off the government, and the government is the people who pay the taxes. Can't there be a better way of allocating these funds so that people get a living wage? And it was only a couple of days ago I hear that on the world stage, countries have agreed that major corporations are going to have to pay 15% tax, period, flat.
That's it.
So,
well,
I
you're
mean,
right. You're right.
We need to go through?
Well, we need to do that. I mean, we've done it in small scale, pilot initiatives where, we've provided, stipends, we provided training, we provided companies with tax credits.
Right.
We've seen it happen where, if a company hires someone who's disabled or if a company hires someone who, is released from prison or, needs, let's say, some sort of stability, that you're given credit, you're given tax credit. And I believe in that. I think the more we can encourage employers, to recognize, look, we know that very often the norm is if you're an employer, you're thinking about profit. You're thinking about hiring the most efficient, the hardest workers, the most skilled workers, which is the norm. Nobody can blame you for that. But we also have a society where, many years ago, if you had somebody, a child who was handicapped or disabled, you're lucky if they finished high school. They generally stayed home and they deteriorated and there was nothing really out there. And why should an employer hire someone who can't see, who has a vision problem or a hearing problem or has a physical disability where they're walking on a cane or in a wheelchair or maybe emotional instability? A lot of these individuals, never had opportunities for work. Society has recognized that, look, let's get these individuals opportunities to work. Agencies like Westchester on the Move and other disability organizations and Jononio, and there's a lot of services that over the last 50 years were established to say, let's make sure that when a special ed child finishes high school, that's not the end of their education. Let's look at ways where we can provide them with career development. We can, give them opportunities where you can go to some of these well-established like Walmart and other businesses and say, look, we want you to hire X amount of disabled young men and women. And in return, we're going to give you tax credits. Well, how does that help us? First of all, that disabled young man or woman is going to feel more productive. They're going to have a job. They're going to feel good about themselves. There's less money society has to pay, for a deterioration of that individual without the job or career. And that's the way, planning works well. Maybe it's my educator hat on. I get upset when I see sometimes kids that we've served for many years in the public school system. They graduate, we get them out. And then, you look back and you say, well, what's happening to that young man or woman? And sure enough, in the past, many of them fell apart. It frustrated families, it frustrated these individuals, and it was a major loss. It was a loss. So, now we see a lot more happening. We on the state level put a ton of funding, additional funding for mental illness program, for a lot of other services that, for example, provide these individuals that are disabled with continuous services. And I've had even reached out to liaisons in Yonkers, individuals that were disabled. One person that continues to be a liaison that reaches out to my office, that tells me the latest on what's happening with the disabled and services that are necessary, is, for example, a woman like Carol Conklin, who goes out of her way to really reach out and make proposals. And sure enough, and I tell individuals all the time, no matter what the area of need, you got to become aware. And some of the awareness is listening to shows like this, Hezzy, where You know, you listen to public officials and media people and commentators speak about what the issues that confront us and basically telling individuals, speak up. There's an issue that confronts your community, you know, whether it's a senior citizen population, an immigrant population, those of us concerned about education or health care or the disabled, speak up. You know, if there's a way that you can reach out to an assembly person, a state senator, if it's an issue on the county or federal level or local level, reach out to your representatives. It doesn't hurt. Speak up and say, hey, I have a concern. Why are we doing this way? Why can't we do something a different way? And then normally my question to an individual, well, what do you recommend? What do you see that's wrong? What do you think we can do to make it better? And you know, I have a track record of having sponsored during my 3 years in the assembly probably the highest level of sponsorship of legislation, dealing with many areas of need. And honestly, the bulk of the recommendations came by talking to people and having people reach out and say, Assemblyman, you know, we're very unhappy about, you know, veteran organization are being charged too much for permits and fees, and we have a lot of our, you know, veteran posts and facilities that are in dire need of repairs. They don't have handicap accessibility. They don't have services, ramps, and whatever. And sure enough, you know, that prompted me to put forth legislation that, for example, allows the counties and municipalities, you know, to waive the fees, you know, when there's repairs or renovations. So a lot of veterans were really happy for that, for example. A lot of things involving gift cards. Now, a lot of people, for example, get a gift card. They expire without you knowing. They add fees on there without you knowing. So, you know, that whole field there needed revision, needed stability. So people spoke up, and sure enough, we sponsored legislation that makes it uniform where, you know, a gift card doesn't expire under 9 years, for example. And a gift card, other than, you know, the initial fees, let's say that may be required initially to put forth a gift card, that they can't add on uncalled for fees later on. So a lot of people in, you know, in the business are very happy and said, you know what, this makes sense. Now at least we know the whole concept of gift card is clear. We know what the responsibilities of the merchants and so forth. The customers are happier. So these type of initiatives may be simple for people, but honestly, that's what it takes. You know, and I always say legislation in New York State, the first step of even proposing any changes is in the assembly where I sit. And it has to be sponsored through legislation in the assembly, and then in the Senate, and then the governor signs off on it, then it becomes the law of the state. You know, and it's amazing how we took initiatives to safeguard nursing homes. We took initiatives to safeguard the rights of immigrants over the years. We took safeguards to make sure that those with disabilities are their needs are addressed. We passed legislation. A lot of older people that historically were thrown in nursing homes, you know, a lot of the families were concerned, rightfully so, with especially with what happened in New York and elsewhere. A lot of the older patients in nursing homes had difficulty. Many of them passed away in nursing homes and hospitals. So now the new trend is for families, you know, to say, you know what, why don't you develop a concept where, you know, if a family member wants to take care of grandma or grandpa or an uncle or an aunt, you know, isn't that better? Where in the past, well, no, if you're a family member, we can't have you because it doesn't look right. But then when you look at it, that's like the best thing, where keep a person at home, you know, allow a family member that let's say knows the individual to provide care, get compensated for it. And honestly, it's a win-win. You know, there's more of a comfort level. You keep seniors in their homes as long as possible, as long as you can manage their care and health needs. And then, rightfully so, if a daughter-in-law, if a niece, if a granddaughter, a grandson, whoever, you know, wants to take care of their loved ones, you know, they let them get compensated. I'm sure they mm-hmm. would provide more adequate care. So that type of initiative was something that a few years ago we would have probably said, well, it doesn't look right. Why pay a granddaughter to take care of her grandma? You know, but if she is and she's spending God knows how many hours, shouldn't she be compensated for it? Isn't that better care yeah. than having somebody unknown or putting somebody in a facility outside their home? So, you know, these are initiatives that really evolved out of not only need, but of people speaking up and saying, you know, the system is unfair. What can we do to change it? And we change it. We pass legislation that allows family members to care for elders. So,
well, you know, that's what's so brilliant about you. You know, not only are you passionate, but you've got compassion. Without compassion, there's nothing to engage in. So otherwise people don't think, you know. They need to know what to invest their time in and what could be productive. So thanks yeah. to you. What are the challenges you're facing now?
Well, now we're looking at sometimes issues that, you know, I'm watching from the national level and state. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a big push with judicial conventions, and now it's become very important where people are realizing that the process of electing, the process of nominating judges, whether on the local or state level, you know, has become crucial. A lot of people are recognizing, you know, we've had these philosophical wars between, you know, political wars between whether, you know, we should move in the direction of, you know, ultra-progressivism to some extent. People review it as socialism, or should our state and communities revert back to some sense of, you know, middle-of-the-road central type of policies. And, you know, and then we're realizing that on a lot of these debates that take place that require legal action and decisions and interpretations really are made by judges, you know, in courts. And so now both sides looking to the future are realizing, hey, we better make sure that in order to protect our views or our interests, that, you know, we get more involved with making sure, you know, the judicial delegates that are elected in communities across the state, you know, believe in the philosophy we want, where if it's ultra-left or ultra-right, and I've always been an advocate, Hezzy, of, you know, trying to be down the middle. You know, you know, for us to function as a nation, as a state, we've learned that the radical left or the radical right doesn't work. You know, and in order to really best represent our state or our nation or our communities, we need to try to motivate and encourage more government that is moderate, government that reflects, you know, both the needs and rights of the left and the right, you know, and at the same time try to put forth a process where, you know, the judicial system is fair and equitable. You know, I even have a bill that, you know, recognizes that the mandatory retirement age for judges at 70 is unfair. Maybe 50 years ago, 75 years ago, you know, a 70-year-old 75 years ago was old. But now we know, you know, with medicine and healthcare and, you know, 70-year-old is like the old 60 or 50. You know, so now we're saying, you know, let's allow judges to continue to serve to 76 in New York State. And, you know, so judicial becomes a crucial area. You know, that's like a silent thing now. But, you know, again, someone like myself looking down the line, that's going to be a key area where we got to start looking at the judicial makeup to make sure that down the line, you know, we continue to promote the most qualified, the most fair, you know, system in place that encourages individuals that are not too ultra either way, you know. So, and then you look at even on the federal with attempts to increase the Supreme Court from like 9 justices to 15, you know, people look at that and say, you know, that's politically motivated, and some people argue both ways. But these are the type of things that, you know, will impact us, and we got to be prepared to see what we can do to change and modify that.
Well, you know, it's very interesting. You know, I'm already 71, so I thought I was being, I was fading away. However, I actually had a triple bypass surgery 3 years ago, and they say that when you have triple bypass, it gives you an extra 20 years lease in life. So it looks like I might last another 17 years.
Yeah,
I don't know
and
if I
listen,
can handle it myself.
Really, but imagine if somebody said, well, you can't get on the radio, you can't get involved with speaking up and having discussions and programs because you're beyond age 70. Or somebody's an attorney, or somebody's a legislator, or somebody is
right.
in business. You know, how can we begin to put, a stop, a gap, you know, and say you can't practice what you do or your business or whatever your profession.
Mm.
You know, so the same goes for judges. You know, that's why, you know, I remember 50 years ago as a young man, I would look at anybody in their 50s and say, wow, this person is old. But times
exactly.
have changed, and times have changed, and we got to begin to reflect that in our policies. And look at New York City. You know, we talked about a shifting of policy. You know, if things stand, and someone like Eric Adams, let's say, continues to take the lead and become the
mm-hmm.
next mayor of New York City, you know, that shows New York City going a little bit more to the middle. You know, we've seen the city go a lot to the left, you know, over the last maybe 10 years. And now, you know, if things hold up and we look at who the new makeup of the city council and especially the mayor, it seems to me it's become more reflective of a shift to the middle. And some people will argue what we spoke about earlier, that maybe that's in the positive direction, that we as a state, as a community, politically need to start making sure that our new representation is more reflective of the general population. So let's
yeah,
see
definitely.
How that goes with the results in New York.
It's going to be very, very exciting, but we're also seeing it up here in Westchester, too, the latest contest. For elected office, some of them were
sure.
very, very close in the primaries, and so it's very compelling what people have done. So even though the turnout wasn't so great, it seems that there is a change that may take place.
Well,
we're not sure yet.
There is, and in Mount Vernon, there was also a race, councilmatic race.
Oh yeah,
that was decided Hezzy by one vote. You know, so when people
Isn't
tell
amazing?
You, why should I vote and why should I go out? And I say to people, look, you know, your vote may be the decisive factor
mm-hmm.
in who wins and who loses. You know,
this
election in Mount Vernon, one council seat, officially as of yesterday, Board of Election results, person won the election by one vote. Imagine thousands of votes
amazing.
Were cast. And one vote determines who represents and who doesn't. You know, so I think the lesson is, you know, speak up, stay involved, have a voice, utilize the process to the fullest, and you know, there's going to be winners and there's going to be losers, and you know, keep it respectful and recognize that, you know, at the end of the day, our goal is, you know, to give people a voice. And for people to follow up, you know, so once you elect a representative, it doesn't mean that's the end of it. And I always say, if you elect a representative, get to know them, reach out, speak to them, you know, stay in touch with them, you know, and give them advice. Don't just complain. Give them advice. Give them, you know, and tell them when they're doing something right, because public officials need to know, hey, I need to know what I'm doing, you know, if it's acceptable or not. You know, sometimes we look at charts and data and success stats, but very often you know, a call, an email, a text, you know, assemblyman, councilman, mayor, whomever, you know what, we really liked, you know, your position on this issue, or, you know, thank you very much for your stand on education, on healthcare.
Yeah.
You know, and that kind of, that's something we got to do more of. You know, sometimes, you know, if all you hear is complaints, you know, it's not the right thing to do, you know.
Absolutely not. And it doesn't encourage people to move in the direction that they might feel is very important. So we need to hear.
That's right.
That's the name of the game.
But,
well, as usual, you've been captivating, compassionate, and just brilliant in your thinking. How do people reach out to your office? Because you've got an exceptionally good staff.
I have a great staff. And, you know, I want to give my number out to my office. You know, as I said, my staff, even throughout the pandemic and to the present,
mm-hmm.
extremely visible, extremely active with unemployment claims, with small business application, with assistance with some of the rent programs we spoke about for rent arrears,
yeah.
people that owe money, you know, and any other concerns. If it's something that's not state related, it might be federal related or local related or county, my staff is trained to refer the constituent, the person that has a concern, to the proper source. So you can always
mm-hmm.
call the offices located. The district office in Yonkers is at 35 East Grassy Sprain Road, room 406. This is where the assembly office has been for over 40 years. And the number there is 914-779-8805. I also have a weekly update. You know, it's like a report to the constituents. So anybody
right.
can call the office. If you don't get my weekly, you know, I encourage anyone listening to call the office, give your email to the staff. This way, every week, you'll get an update on state services, local services. This way, I want the constituents to know what the assemblyman, their representative is doing, what the staff, what the office, what's happening on the state level, what's happening with change of policy or law, what benefits are available for the constituents. And it's a great way to stay informed, a great way to be aware, and really have a voice, and really know at all levels what your representatives are doing. So please contact the office. If you're not on the list, put your name, your email, so you can get the weekly updates, and stay informed. And don't ever hesitate. If you have issues or concerns, you can always call the office and set up an appointment to come speak. And we'll be more than glad to sit and try to be of help to you.
Well, thank you, Assemblyman, for all your time. It's always a pleasure. Enjoy the weekend. Enjoy the 4th of July.
A very happy 4th of July. Celebrate. Stay safe. And, again, stay patriotic. And, again, my message is always, you know, we're one nation. We're one people. We're under one flag, one constitution. And let's keep it that way.
Terrific. All the best. Thank you again, sir.
Take care, Hezzy. God bless.
You too, sir. Bye. Okay, well, our next guest is none other than Richard Thomas. He's a former Mount Vernon mayor, and so we're going to speak to him. Good morning, Mr. Mayor. How are you?
Good morning. Good morning.
Well, I've always wanted to ask. I hear that so often where people say, good morning, good morning, good morning. Where did that come from? Because that's before my time in this country. You know, because I hear it from so many people. They repeat it. Is that because
they
think I'm deaf or what? Well, it's going to be really good. At least I guess this way they do know that we hear them. So what's going on in your world? I guess one of the most exciting is that we still don't have a final figure on some of the close political races that took place in Mount Vernon. And the numbers were so close. You know, sometimes less than 50 points, 50 ballots. Do we know where things are going? Are we seeing a new day dawning in Mount Vernon? Oh, wait, some reason or another. Hello?
Hey, there you go. Can you hear me now, Hezzy?
Yeah, now I can.
Great.
Well, good morning. And
good morning.
I want to ask you where that whole concept of good morning, and sometimes even good morning a third time comes from, and more importantly, the political contests that have transpired and are being counted as we speak. The contests are so close. Sometimes less than 50 votes separate people who will eventually accede to that position or that will fail. Are we seeing a change? Even if the numbers don't prove out, are we seeing a change from the old guard to a new guard?
I believe there's always been a struggle for a new guard to rise up and get the old guard to relinquish their grip on power. And I believe that we're seeing play out now more than ever, especially with the recent results of the race in Mount Vernon. I do have my suspicions as to why the race is so close, but I'm happy that the results appear in favor of the group that really is independent of the political trappings of the past.
Well, you know, what made the Mount Vernon Forward team so successful? Even if they don't win, they have made a major impact, and the old guard have literally been challenged to the core. Even if they don't win, it doesn't matter. It's showing a direction to rid the past and create a new future, or at least an effort to do so.
I believe that the proof is in the pudding, for lack of a better phrase. When you look at the past few races in Mount Vernon, you'll see that many of the candidates did not have a race at all. The old guard eliminated the competition by removing people from the ballot. They bring people into court.
Right.
They bring people into court and make them pay exorbitant amounts of money to defend themselves in their campaign. Most of the times, people don't have that ability to spend $50,000, $75,000, $100,000 to fight that fight in court. So when you look at the people that have gotten elected in Mount Vernon very critically, you'll see most of them never really had a race. It's the people that will challenge the status quo. They get put into these very, tough situations like we see right now. And the good thing is, all efforts were exhausted to make sure that the race cannot be stolen like other races have been stolen in the past.
Well, you know what I found interesting is that despite the fact that it seems very close between all the contestants in the race for city council and other positions, only a few contests were really blown out the door. Was it Reverend Morton won the controller's position? And so that was very unique among all the people who voted for a candidate. But the others were so close, and yet the number of people who came out to vote was really quite paltry. So who came out to vote? Are those people the invested in the new candidates and those who were invested in the older candidates? So did the people speak up, or are the people still on the sideline?
So just in case, people can't hear you or can't hear me, I'm just going to repeat the question. The question was who came out to vote? And people came out in actually larger numbers than revealed to vote. The question is how many people were rejected, how many ballots disappeared. The question is how were people treated when they went to the polls to vote? And, the Board of Elections, they're not infallible. When you look at their track record, they are full of, a lot of question marks there. And you can see the same situation happen in New York City with the ranked choice voting debacle that's going on. So when you have, interests, especially political interests, at risk of losing their political power, they're going to stop at nothing to try and rig the results to their favor. So,
well, that's what I got to ask you. I mean, you made the implication or the inference a few times now, and it sounds like it went over my head. But how is the process maligned in such a way to maintain the old guard, whoever they may be, in play, and diminishes the capacity for new challengers to come in to the forefront of the political system? How do we do that when I feel everything was supposed to be regulated? Or is that just for the simple-minded like me who may think, well, they're supposed to be following rules and regulations, when evidently I know they don't, whoever they may be?
So
that's a problem I see everywhere.
Right. So the question, is, how can the old guard trick the public into believing that, the public and the people did not win? What are the tactics that the old guard uses to, rig elections and rig results to their favor? So I'm going to give
I'm riveted. I'm
going to give
you an answer on this one.
Yeah, I'm going to give you two examples of things that we hear often in the news. We often hear about problems with the voting machines. Some of the machines are not. And then when those machines don't work, they then have to go to a paper process. And then it becomes a question of who is really controlling the paper. Who's watching the amount of paper going into the bag, the ballot bag, and how secure are those bags? And that's where you have to watch the margins, because it's very hard to track that if you don't have real independent people watching those broken machines and how they go about facilitating the vote at that point of input. So if you have a bad input, you're going to have a bad output. And that's how they make it close. And you always hear about, voting machines are messed up and broken. But you don't hear about voting processes messed up on America's Got Talent. You just don't. People call in, they give their vote, they're tallied, and that's it. So I don't understand why it's so difficult to, facilitate an election where we have more at stake, but we always seem to have questions and suspicions about it being rigged. Well, that's because politics and their political interests at work that want it to stay this way, where they can influence the outcome to benefit a group of people that are in power that want to stay in power. And that's how they do it. So that's one tactic that I gave you. There's another tactic, but it's far more, it's not just complicated. It's very hard to really get to the core of it, because then you have to gain access to the Board of Elections files. And in their files, you'll be able to see how they change the enrollment of voters from active to inactive, from a voter being registered to vote to not being registered to vote. And the discretion of the party chairs to determine whether or not someone is active or inactive or eligible or ineligible. These are all different designations that would internally eliminate their vote. And these people don't even know that they're in this kind of, barren land of being stranded from voting. But that's how they dispossess people from their right to vote. And it's very much the same as what's happening in Georgia, Florida, Texas, Idaho. It's all the same. It's not just Republicans doing it across the country. It's Democrats here in Westchester County, particularly Mount Vernon.
Well, that's what I got to ask you, too. I mean, I didn't hear that usually spoken about in Westchester County. But when I did hear it being spoken about, it's like either the dead that have risen to be voting for over 100 years, which is an impossibility for most people. But then you hear that it was a white-black issue, and now you're suggesting that this might even be the same problem in a city that's predominantly the majority who are black. And so are people still being marginalized by this process? So why is it that government doesn't look into it from a particular community say, no, this can't be. We can't allow it.
So I'm going to ask if you can just restate that, because for some reason the phone on my end was coming in and out, and I couldn't make out your question.
No problem. Let's just see if this works.
Yeah, it's
was
still coming in messy, I don't know what's going on. The connection here. I'm on a landline. But while,
okay.
The signals get recalibrated, I do want to extend my prayers to Freda Hickson and her daughter, who's battling a critical injury out of state, and praying for a speedy recovery as she keeps hanging on.
Well, let's hope so. God bless.
I hear you, Heather. Can you state your question again?
Yeah, I was wondering. I used to think that this issue about marginalizing voters was based on a color line, but now in a place like Mount Vernon, which is predominantly of African-American descent and other people of color,
mm-hmm.
I would think that it would be less prevalent. Why does it still continue? Is this actually a blind situation where color means nothing, religion means nothing, ethnicity means nothing? It's all about the politician staying in power?
I believe that the only color that matters to people in power is green. It's money. Money power. That's what really matters. It's not about your ethnicity and your race. I think they use that as a distraction to get people to focus on things that really do not matter. They dramatize and personalize the conflicts to get people to miss the real point of, who is benefiting monetarily from the situation. And in Mount Vernon specifically, you have to ask the question of, who benefits from a financial standpoint with the city so broken and trapped in chaos. And it's not that hard to see who's benefiting. It's certain very specific contractors who have gotten these very lucrative contracts without bidding, without involving the public, and the people in charge in the administration, they're not looking to people in the community, people in the city, to do the work for the city with their own tax dollars. So it's obvious that these people that are in place are, putting in their friends or the people that help them get in position, as opposed to protecting the people and advancing good policy.
I can't challenge your, the issues that you're bringing forward, because I'm not familiar with them. But the question then is, who is going to cast these aspersions and validate them? Is there no mechanism, no matter what government you have, no matter what their bias or why they move in one direction or another, to do their own bidding or not to oversee what's going on under their watch? How do we change that reality? Is there no mechanism that people are aware of?
We have the mechanism. The mechanism is for people to go vote and to get people in office that are going to make better decisions. And that's what you see with this Mount Vernon.
But that's so simple. And the problem is that most people don't know who to vote for anyway. They're voting for their friends. Who's going to tell us who's been undermining the whole process and where are the names? Can't we find out what is happening? Because nobody talks.
Right.
That's
not
the reason we're in trouble.
Right. Not enough people talk, and when you do talk, you risk retribution by, the forces that want to keep the status quo.
Wait a minute. That's a very valid point. Guess what? That's what the media is here for.
Right. And
doesn't
and,
matter.
And
they sue me all the time. So what?
Right, and that's why we need news platforms like yours, and we need people to keep asking the questions, because when you ask great questions, you're supposed to get a great answer. And I got a note the other day from someone that was a huge critic of mine, and they finally got through all the evidence. They looked at new developments in the city, and they said, wow, you really were set up. You really were, you know, put in a terrible situation. And when you look carefully at the cost centers of Mount Vernon, they all operate in the dark. And the question is, why? How come a city with a $120 million budget cannot reveal, you know, its real inner workings to the people that are paying the bill? The problem there you know, and that goes to the heart of the issue that, we're talking about. It's money.
Who's
power.
At fault? Who's at fault then? That's the comptroller's office that failed, didn't it?
It's more well
didn't
in
the
Mount
controller,
Vernon. Yeah, in Mount Vernon's case, it's more than just the controller. There are other powers that have turned a blind eye to what's going on here. And it goes, you know, to the Attorney General's office, it goes to the Governor's office, it goes to the State Comptroller's office, all these different offices that are supposed to have some kind of authority to help fix problems are choosing not to fix the problem in Mount Vernon. In time, we may find out why, or we may never find out. But what I do know is Mount Vernon is on a much better road to a future that is more fair. And I mean that in its most simplistic form, because you now have a group of public officials coming in that are not connected to the problems and the interests that have trapped Mount Vernon in the past. That's been the whole thing. How long can they keep Mount Vernon in this circle, in this donut hole, while everybody else improves? Mount Vernon just keeps, you know, wallowing in the mud and wallowing in all of its old problems and not solving the real problems that need to be solved. So I hope that this new group that's coming in will take the steps that they said they will take to help Mount Vernon grow. And that's an exciting proposition because it's been far too long for Mount Vernon to be held back. And I finally believe that we're in position to start moving forward.
Well, you know, that all sounds wonderful, but then when the candidates came out there and told people what their positions were, they were not succinct. You know, it was almost like a personal issue. Well, vote for me because, you know, I'm 6 foot tall, or because I'm a lawyer, or because I'm a friend of this one or a friend of that one. You know, I did such a good job in my employment, and I want to become somebody to represent you. But we still don't know the facts. We're just hoping against all hope that these people will be fresh and conducive to working to benefit the city. And so we really don't even know who we're voting for quite often. And even once we vote them into office, they hang around for 4 years, do whatever they please, and then because we know their name, we vote for them again. Because we don't know anybody else.
Right.
How do we break the cycle?
Right. So you break the cycle of getting to know who you're voting for by asking a lot of questions. And I believe that in the situation in Mount Vernon, the people have seen many of the people that are, A, in office. They've seen what they've done. They've been victim to the bad decisions that were made by many of the people that were running for office before. Think about the raw sewage in basements. Go back to 2003, you know, when this first became an issue, and it was ignored until I became mayor in 2016. And then when I started putting the answers and solutions forward, they were blocked by some of the people that were trying to get in office in this past election cycle. But the people remembered that they were literally crapped on by these people and said, I'm not voting for that person. They already crapped on me before. They're going to crap on me again. So that's the truth. And I've always said this. I've always said this to people that oppose, you know, my approach to public service, which is serving the public. The people that oppose that, I said to them, if you just do your job and support the right thing, you're going to have support not just from me, but you're going to have support from the people. The people are going to support you if you support them. But obviously, the people that lost this past election, have been held accountable by the voters, because the voters remembered that they got crapped on by the people running for office. And they didn't want to put them back in.
Yeah, well, the only problem is for that was that whoever lost out in this process, because they didn't gain the votes and they were the old guard, however they were related to them, either they were in office or they were friends of people in office and so on and so forth. At the end, why is it that the public had to figure this out on their own and the political, I guess people in the political realm never told it to them? So we don't know what questions to ask unless we're told what the problem is.
So let me,
not
let me,
everybody
let me just,
suffered the, you know, the problem with the sewage.
Let me paraphrase.
Others didn't.
It came up broken up. I want to make sure I got it. You know, how come the public is just now finding out, and how come we're just now getting to this point of having new people step up, go in office? Right. So as I mentioned before, people have stepped up to try and run for office in Mount Vernon, but they were removed from the ballot. And those people that were removed from the ballot by the old guard, they didn't have the financial means to fight it out in court. So when you think about...
Besides fighting it out in court, you know, everybody thinks the court has not been that good. Look at the trouble you had in your administration. Look at the troubles that were had by the Sean Patterson Howard administration. And that's the way it went. But if not advised...
Let me jump in right there just very briefly. The point is about choice. Mm-hmm. If you cannot choose, you cannot have a choice. It's a very fundamental, simple point, but it's very profound. If, for example, I was put into that situation when I was, you know, campaigning to run for controller, they put me in court, they removed me from the ballot, leaving behind Darren Morton, Derrickson Lawrence, and Marcus Griffin. So I had a choice on the ballot. And so I knew that it would cost well over $100,000, and it would be uncertain as to whether or not we would be victorious, because the way the courts operate, the law being very narrow at times, it's very hard to, you know, get the decisions that are just. However, it's still the system that we have, and we have to rely upon. But in this case, I'm just pointing out that I'm no different than the people that ran for office in the past. Because back in 2017, when there was a council, the candidates that were running for office, the main opposition, they were removed from the ballot, creating a non-race for the people that were on the city council that created the problems and made the problem worse in Mount Vernon. So that's the point I'm making. There wasn't even a race. It was just a ceremony of sorts, because the old guard focuses on eliminating the competition before they can compete. So
I don't disagree with you at all. In fact, I do agree with you. The only issue here in that situation was that when it happened, there was no explanation of what transpired, how it took place, the logic for people to know before, even if you were excluded from the process, and they made sure that you wouldn't be part of the process was not explained to people so that they could say, oh, well, we didn't know these people were involved in undermining your campaign on a legitimate basis, but they used every trick under the sun to make sure that you wouldn't be involved because they wanted one of theirs, and one of theirs was one of those other three or other two. We don't know until years later. The public doesn't know.
Of power, it creates silence. It silences the past. And when you silence the past, that is raw, evil power that does not
it
want
is.
You. To discover your own power. And that's where
Absolutely
and why
right.
I'm out of Mount Vernon, not giving up on Mount Vernon. And I'm proud of it, because think about it. You know, you had three candidates that were completely opposed to the regime of the status quo, and mm-hmm. and they took it on, and they were able to withstand the challenge because the people are not only watching, they're frustrated, and they don't want the same old, same old. They never wanted the same old, same old. They want better. But thankfully, enough people came out and enough people were watching the process to make sure that the old guard does not steal it to keep Mount Vernon trapped in the past. That's the mm-hmm. that's the bottom line based point here. And from a power dynamic, a power standpoint, there are many lessons to learn, many lessons to pour through from a historical standpoint. But I'm more excited about the future that we will script because we now have a chance to break away from, you know, the past. There's the past mm-hmm. is not all bad, but we don't need to keep talking about it. We need to say, let's make the situation better. Let's fix the roads so we don't have to worry about potholes. Let's fix the parks. Let's build up the police department again. Let's fix the things that need to be fixed. And there's no excuse. I mean, there's tons of money, tons. So there's no excuse. And I think I may have lost you because I don't hear you.
Yeah, for a moment, all I heard was there is no excuse for, and that was when I lost you.
Yeah. For people watching and listening, this goes back to mm-hmm. my point that whenever I call in the Hezzy Show, there's always something. I don't know if it's my line or his line, but there's always something where the lines get crossed and tangled, and we have but we don't stop. That's the thing. That's the opposition trying to keep us from discussing what's really happening. And one of the things that I definitely want to discuss was Trump. I wanted to discuss the situation with Trump because I just feel that, you know, it's just a bit odd that they would spend millions of dollars trying to pour through, you know.
Cut you out again. Oh, God. Can you hear me? Okay. All right. For some reason, I don't hear you again. Hello? Okay, let me see if I can get him. Bear with me a moment. Let's see if we can do this. All right, let's try one of these numbers and see if that works.
Is that you, Hezzy?
Yeah, that's me. Somehow we lost you there.
Yeah,
so you wanted
yeah, I don't
to
know
talk
what's going
about
on.
Trump, that's... and you said something about you don't know how much money was spent for what. That's where I lost you.
Talking about Trump, I was basically,
yes.
You know, I'm a bit sympathetic to the situation that's going on with Donald Trump, our former president. I'm sympathetic because it's like I think about the issues of like bail reform and how they let real criminals back out onto the street, the Democrats that pushed for this, and they are like real criminals with gun possession that they just let back out onto the street to get illegal guns and shoot people, like my nephew who got shot a couple weeks
mm-hmm.
ago, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I look at
yep.
this and I say, how come you're not putting the effort that you put in to go after Trump? You're settling a political score. Why not protect the people? And that's where I get painted as the black sheep of the Democratic Party because I really focus on what's right. And I believe it's wrong for them to go back and criminalize, you know, this business after 15 years. Think about it. 15 years of them doing business and taxes, the New York State Finance Authority, New York City Tax, the IRS, they all had the option to scrutinize and go through their taxes. Each of these organizations had that opportunity, but they did not. And if they did, it's civil. It's not criminal. So I'm my mind is blown because here we go again. And it just goes to show you how bad politics can really, really take a toxic turn and just ruin people because they want to do what's right. And I can't, again, I want to emphasize, I do not support Donald Trump. I'm not a supporter. I just look at the issue and say, that's right or that's wrong. And what I see right now is happening, I believe it's wrong.
Well, you know, there is an adversarial situation that was fomented under Trump's era, you know, being there for almost 4 years. But the thing that was interesting is it had a lot to do with personality. He offended a lot of people. It doesn't mean he was wrong, but he offended a lot of people. And then the response was strictly adversarial. And we've come to the point where there's a schism in our discussion as a society, and it's either you're for or against, and with no concern whatsoever to find if there really is a middle ground or a balance. And that becomes a problem. So, you know, you got to be a sort of guy that people like, or a sort of woman that people like. And
it's
if you
to
get
go
too
along
abrasive,
and,
it's and, too and much. What, for the,
go ahead,
pro,
and I don't mean
process.
To jump in. Like, you came in broken up a lot, and somebody pointed out there was sound issues. And the point that Hezzy was making is that it's adversarial. There are egotistical issues. There's animosity toward Donald Trump. And you know, he's not a guy that obviously the group likes, and that's why they're going after him. And that's the point that Hezzy was making. And I was picking that up because I'm closer to the phone, but I just want to point out to all those people that are watching and listening that may have sound issues, you know, what Hezzy was saying.
Well, I appreciate that. So how do we jump into the political swimming pool, so to speak, and do the job that the public hopes that we will do for them? How can we be responsive considering the past and that we need to create a new future, which is open and revealing?
Let's talk about that very briefly, because it's going to be rough starting in maybe mid-August, early September. And it's going to be rough because the moratoriums on evictions and the moratoriums on all these payments and the cushy unemployment checks are going to stop. And then the problem is going to become, where are the jobs? Where's the work? And what we don't see is enough effort to help businesses do business, and that's the collateral damage of this case against Donald Trump. You now have businesses that would have liked to done business in New York, and they're going to say, well, if I make a political stance in opposition to the dominant group, maybe I will get, you know, persecuted because I chose a different set of politics. And people want to, you know, claim issues again with Trump, but there's no difference between Putin's politics and New York State Democrats' politics and going after Donald Trump right now. They're very much the same. And so when you have that element, that toxicity, you really create an aversion of people that don't want to invest and are going to take their resources, their jobs, and their dollars elsewhere. And that's the consequence. And I can break it all the way down to Mount Vernon, because you can look and see at the garbage piling up on the streets. You can look and see at the development projects that are just languishing without enforcement. You can look and see the development projects that have been abandoned because of the red tape and the incompetence. And that talks the politics, and that politics is preventing good policy. And that's where I say, look, I'm hoping that at some point we can create a future without such blood sport politics, because it doesn't serve anybody but the egos that want to settle a political score. Like, come on, that's it. There's nothing more than that, and it's that simple.
Well, you're 100% right on that front, as usual. So how do we move beyond this? How do we inform the public of what's really going on? How do they when you hear so many people on the political stage telling us, well, Memorial Field is going to be done, we've invested this, we've invested in that, where it doesn't show up. So, but we've been talking a great game now for over 5 years. Well, what are we doing? And nobody's held accountable for it.
Well, and that's where, you know, a lot of good people choose not to go into public service because they get persecuted, they get attacked, they get lied on. Their businesses are threatened. And to me, you know, watching this, having survived some of this stuff, I look at it and I say, that's the problem. And that's why we need people like you, your news, you know, platform, to challenge power, to explain themselves, to not silence the truth. And we need candidates that are courageous to take on the real issues, like this Mount Vernon Forward team, like mm-hmm. what I started. And you see the work and the effort continues. It's not just one person. There are now three people that are going to be entering mm-hmm. council, tilting it, joining a fourth person, Derek Thompson, who I helped get elected to the council. So there are four people now on the council
yeah.
that I've successfully pushed. So I see it as a real, you know, turn toward the center again. We're not going to the radical left. We're not going to the extreme right. We're just going right down the middle to make good progress. There's no reason for us to have, you know, the problems we have, the violence, the high taxes. We don't need all that. We can make Mount Vernon a glorious retirement community where grandparents and grandchildren can gather and they can, you know, have fun in a safe manner and they can, you know, punish the parents who are the common enemy of, you know, mm-hmm. grandparents and grandchildren. So that's a virtuous outlook. But with respect to you know, what's going on in totality, we really need all different parties, all different tribes to agree that the pothole needs to be fixed, agree to agree that the raw sewage needs to stop leaking in basements, agree to agree that we're going to really reduce taxes. And they have to stay at that table no matter how, you know, tense it gets. They have to work to solve that problem.
Well, I saw something that really resolved a big problem. It was an email that was flying about in mostly in Mount Vernon about noise
yeah.
In one of the parks. And I remember reading somebody made a statement, is that all you're interested in? As if it was really, it was too pity, too puny a concept to even think about. But I found it to be the most brilliant desire to put an end to something that people were not comfortable with. And because they succeeded in putting a stop to all this noise pollution that offended them, it showed them that if they got together, they could do something.
That's
and
right.
I know it's a really simple issue, but it's the beginning of the change, and that will move Mount Vernon forward, because if they can do this, then they can do so much more.
Right, and that's why I'm excited about this new group, because now we have a new group of people that are not beholden to outdated, obsolete politics.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm looking forward to is, you know, hopefully we can modernize our housing. Hopefully we can get closer to incentivizing businesses to put some real jobs here. But
mm-hmm.
it's going to work, and it's not going to happen overnight. I'm not romanticizing that this group is going to wave a magic wand and it's all going to be done. No, it's going to take time, and it's going to take for people
who
typically do not like each other to take a position and step back and say, okay, while we may not personally get along, professionally we have to address these issues, and that's what must happen, no matter how hard you know, efforts were made. It didn't happen before because, you know, I was outnumbered. But now the numbers are tilting in favor of more progressive people, and that's where I get excited because now, you know, the idea of having a basketball court with a net on it, you know, so kids can play basketball and hear the swoosh of the net, that's a simple
yeah.
concept, right? You take it for granted, but it's important. You know, you think about baseball. You think about the baseball diamond. If it's not ready, if they don't have the chalk to put down on the lines, they can't really play the game.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have enough equipment. And equipment is very affordable, especially with high taxes. How come the money's not reaching the places and people you need it to reach? And I go back to my nephew, who was shot, who was an honor student going to Stony Brook for a full academic scholarship for music, an introvert. Mm. Just went to the store for cookies and milk. Think about it. It's shot near his home because the streets are unsafe, because the policy positions taken and the positions allowed to fester, defunding the police, demoralizing the police, humiliating the police, reducing their numbers. That doesn't help. It doesn't work. Bail reform on top of that, making it possible for the criminals that have the real weapons to hurt people. They're the ones that's protected, not the people, not my nephew. And I go back to the Democrats in office that can change this, but they don't. They want to, they just waffle. We need results.
Well, where is the incentive for the politicians who have the power at the moment to keep this derogatory sort of standard in play? Why is that permitted? And
you know,
are the politicians not interested in slugging it out with and changing the dynamic?
You know, I really can't give you an answer on that because I don't think the way they think. I think very differently. I think very, you know, business. I think both outcome. I don't have that political calculus as to saying it's a good idea to let someone that was arrested 45 times out on the street another time, and you know, let them have their illegal gun back. I can never agree with that. But in the face of this issue, and we've seen the numbers, we've seen the issue play out. They're still silent and they've done nothing about it. And I want to put one more issue that's explosive on the table. And this is an issue that will, I believe, really show some of the people that are in power, I believe it will expose them for being the frauds that they are. And it's about marijuana, the legalization of marijuana. Ezzy, you got people in prison now that just smoked a joint. You got people that were drug dealers, right? That were, you know, according to the laws of that time, they did a crime, and they're paying the result of that. However, when you look at the way the rules are being written now for the legalization of marijuana, unless you're like a Fortune 100 company with hundreds of thousands of dollars, you cannot get a license to sell marijuana legally unless you're this corporate company, this entity. So you mean to tell me the people that literally are killing themselves to sell marijuana in black and brown communities are 100% excluded from the legalization of marijuana? Think about that. These are the people that voted for.
Well, I realize that. That's the problem. They don't have to necessarily be selling drugs, whether it be marijuana or anything else. We have to give them employment, and we're not doing it. We talk a good game, but how do you feed yourself if you got no food? How does an Eric Garner die? Because he's trying to sell Lucy's in front of a store, and because the cops didn't know how to handle his size he got killed. He needs he needs to feed himself.
There you go. And that's where I am. And it's like, how come when they were writing the law, they didn't include a process, a path to participation? They want to talk about a path to immigration for illegal immigrants to come into this country, right? That's what they want to do. They want to talk about that. They want to, you know, continue the border wall under a different guise because, you know, they're embarrassed to say that they were wrong. But it comes to marijuana and legalization, there's no path to participation. There's no economic empowerment. It's all inequality. And that's what really frustrates me because here you go. You got people that would love to invest their $5,000, $10,000 and compete with each other honestly, right? Or form businesses together to compete. But they're not going to come up with the couple hundred thousand that they made the bar to only allow wealthy groups.
But you know how it's done? It's been done by one ethnic group after another for hundreds of years. And I know people may not like Reverend Farrakhan, but he's got a good concept. You've got to invest in your own community. And the point is because others are not investing in the community. Point is that why not form something like if anybody's got $500 to invest, you can create a corporate structure where everybody has an equal say in the structure, but it'll be run professionally by people and they'll all make a buck on it when things sell. So, yeah, why not? Why not have a store like that in Mount Vernon?
Well, I will definitely raise that concept back to some people that raised it before, but they can't get a response from City Hall. They can't get a response from the county or Albany.
But you don't need to. You know what? The point is, it's a great idea that you came up with or that others have come up with. It doesn't matter. There's no reason to steal anything. But the point is, it's a great concept. And you don't need authority from Mount Vernon or from the county or any other place. You just need to file a corporate structure. And if you need to promote it for business, hey, I'll be happy to promote it. Why not? Give people an opportunity to get into the game. Now,
well, we're going to dive into this issue, I know,
now.
In our next talk. And I just want to emphasize that, you know, if there was a path to participation, a path to economic improvement on marijuana. And again, I will take a very careful and close look at this because I believe that there's a big market on this. But there are other issues when you don't have jobs that pop up, like zombie properties, you have the shootings, and you definitely feel hope that it can't be solved. But it can be solved when you give people options and alternatives. And when you have, let's say, Main Street boxing, when they're competing for the attention of that 13-year-old to 18-year-old, saying instead of going out and standing on a street corner, you know, trying to impress knuckleheads, come into the ring and impress your parents, impress yourself. When they are able to compete for that young person's attention and they have something to do that's destructive, that is how you start addressing the issues of safety and crime, because that's how you start taking away the literal manpower or people power that create the problems. When it comes to zombie properties, the city, the administration, must have the will and the political, not even political, the policy structure to deal with those issues. And despite all good efforts that were put in place in the past with Harvard and the World Economic Forum and you know, having DPW really attack these zombie properties, there was no will by the then city council to deal with the properties, and the then controller, right? The controller was unwilling to help move these zombie properties into life again. But I go back to the point of what we were discussing at the top of the show was we got a new controller coming in with Reverend Darren Morton. definitely believe he's a bridge to our future, a much better one. We got a new city council group coming in that's not beholden to the trappings of the political past. And we finally may have, you know, a narrow window to really create, use our power to create as opposed to destroy. And that's where, you know, I'm going to keep emphasizing and repeating, if Mount Vernon continues on a path to prosperity, I will support whoever's in office to make Mount Vernon more prosperous. I don't need to be in office to make it happen. I don't want the credit. I never was out for the credit. I was out to get it done and get it started because I know how important it was to move forward. So I just want to, restate that. Let's make it happen. Let's just move on. And if the more we move on, the better it'll become. But we really need people in office that want it better. And I think we finally have a group that are finally ready to make Mount Vernon better.
Well, absolutely. That sounds, it's a perfect way to end the day. and a great way to end the week. But you're definitely on the right track, and I think it's just focusing people's attention to your concepts, and that'll make it happen. You just need to know how it can be done. It has to be spelled out.
And that's,
so it's
and that's
getting there.
To ask the tough questions and to, ask these questions and just keep the platform strong, because without a platform like yours, we can't go into the issues and shine a light in some of the darkest corners.
Well, thank you for that. But it takes a mind to be able to, educate the rest of us. So thank you for that. Well, have a great weekend. Have a happy 4th of July. Stay safe. Be well. We'll speak to you next week, sir.
You got it. Thank you. Happy 4th.
Thank you. All the best. Bye. We've got to get going, so we'll speak to you on Monday. All the best. Bye.